court is ready to hear argument in 070815 Intercontinental Group Partnership versus KB Home Lone Star LP.
May it please the court, Mr. Castillo will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. On behalf of Intercontinental Group, it's we welcome the opportunity to present this issue to this court. We obviously think that the trial court, the Honorable Bobby Flores, abused his discretion when he entered a judgment awarding attorney's fees for KB Home in this underlying litigation that we went to a jury, tried in 2006, and was submitted to the jury in connection with both KB Home's affirmative claim for breach of contract and the defendant's numerous defenses and counterclaims. At the end of the day, the jury answered the question on KB Home's only affirmative claim for relief, the breach of contract, two issues. The first issue was on the breach of contract. The jury answered, obviously, yes. On the second question that was conditioned on a finding of liability, the jury found zero damages.
Why did they do that? What was your argument that KB Homes hadn't been damaged?
As the trial, one of the trial lawyers, and I think it really played on the cross-examination of KB Homes' main expert, who indicated that he had a pattern of developing these types of communities in the valley, including Laredo. And I was able to demonstrate to the jury through their own numbers that we actually did KB Home a favor because they had lost money on each one of their developments in that pattern. And so the jury, when they came back and they looked at, did KB Home suffer damages, that was the evidence that was submitted to them, that KB Homes had not been damaged. They had not bought these lots, and had they bought these lots, they probably would have lost.
Did you move for directed verdict at any point during trial? On the no damages point.
I think both parties moved for a directed verdict. I, as the defendant, did move for a directed verdict on one, no liability, on each of the issues that there was obviously excused, that the defendant's breach was excused, and that there was no damages.
And if the trial court had granted your directed verdict at that point, before it went to the jury, who would have been the prevailing party?
If the trial court had granted the
your directed verdict based on no evidence of damages.
In my view, the prevailing party would have been the defendant, Intercontinental Group, because a judgment would have been entered at that point that the plaintiff take nothing.
And if you had moved for summary judgment on that no damages point and the trial court had granted your summary judgment, there would have been no breach of contract finding ultimately, correct?
There would not have been any breach of contract finding at all.
So you would still have been a prevailing party then?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the prevailing party, as that term of art is used in a prevailing party contract provision, maybe not under statutes, maybe not under Chapter 38, because as this court knows, under Chapter 38, only a plaintiff can recover attorney's fees. A defendant has no situation where he's being sued under Chapter 38 to be able to recover attorney's fees for prevailing. So in this instance, where there is a prevailing party provision,
somebody's going to get attorney's fees.
Somebody's going to get attorney's fees.
And why should that be the party that the jury found breached the contract?
Because the cause of action for breach of contract is not just, it has several elements. The existence of the elements include the existence of a contract, the breach by the defendant, and the damages were caused by that breach.
Let me give you a hypothetical. If instead, in your case, if KB Homes usually made money on these projects, but the subprime mortgage mess happened after your client breached the contract, and so because of factors in the general market, nothing having to do with the parties, the market plummets, and as a result of something entirely extraneous, that's why there was no damages. So not because, you know, your clients were good guys and saving these people money by breaching the contract, but just because the market collapsed. Why should your client then get attorney's fees because of a fortuity?
Well, in that case, I really don't think it would be a fortuitous event.
My hypothetical it is. If I would have made money buying these lots, and I file suit, and we're about to go to trial, and the market collapses, which changes everything, so it turns out these lots are not worth nearly as much, through an entire fortuity. Why should that fortuity mean Sorry, the defendant gets the attorney's fees rather than the plaintiff.
Because the defendant is still bringing this action, prosecuting this action to enforce that contract. And the reason that he brings the contract for is for breach of contract and damages resulting therefrom. And there has been a change in circumstances under your scenario where now there is no damage. Does he continue to prosecute his claim? Does he present the evidence? Does the plaintiff present the evidence to say, they breached the contract, but jury, we have not been damaged. We're not asking you for any damages. What relief at that point are they still asking for? Why are they prosecuting the claim? Why are they seeking to enforce the contract? What is the relief that they're asking for?
Until the market collapsed, they had damages.
And that happens. That probably is not a...
So because of something unforeseeable, it turns out they can't collect. But now they have to pay all of your attorney's fees.
What?
That just seems like it seems to take attorney's fees away from any connection with who was right and who was wrong.
Well, it would in that situation, but the converse would be true as well. How could KB Homes recover attorney's fees when it doesn't prosecute its action and has not suffered any damages? Sure, there is a breach, and there's many situations where then no one would ever stipulate, to liability on negligence.
But you claimed in this case that you're a prevailing party as well.
Absolutely.
And you don't have a judgment for damages.
Absolutely. Because the definition of prevailing party is someone who is vindicated by the judgment. And the judgment vindication is a take-nothing judgment.
You also didn't prove up attorney's fees. You didn't have a jury question on fees.
We had a jury question on fees under Chapter 38 that was tied to an oral agreement. Had nothing to do with a Santa Clara lot contract.
Right.
And the provision in this particular case says attorney's fees as fixed by the court.
Well, fixed by the court can mean a judgment that is based on a jury verdict, right?
The judgment on the underlying claims is entered into the judgment. Then the issue is who is the prevailing party after you get that judgment. And then that application for attorney's fees is to be fixed by the court. It's very similar to, for instance, a claim under the Texas Labor Code. Who is the prevailing party? You get a prevailing party of finding a discrimination or retaliatory discharge. You get nominal damages. Then there's an application for attorney's fees to the court because you are the prevailing party or you're not the prevailing party. It's very similar. This language in the contract says as fixed by the court. But to answer your question, we did not get a jury finding on our attorney's fees under Chapter 38, and it wasn't submitted under prevailing party.
Because the trial judge was supposed to do that.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Where do you get your definition for prevailing party? Where are you finding that language?
Prevailing party, we're finding that language in a couple of places. One, prevailing party is used in statutes and it's used in contracts, and courts struggle to figure out where is prevailing party defined. Prevailing party is not defined in any of the statutes either. And so the United States Supreme Court in Farrar went to prevailing party and said, prevailing party is a term of art. We look to Black's Law Dictionary to determine how it's used. And it says, a party who is vindicated by the judgment, regardless of the amount of the damages. And I think this court in the Southwestern Bell versus Franco case also looked at the Farrar opinion and said, we look not at the jury verdict. We look at the judgment. And we look at whether the judgment vindicates a party, regardless of the amount of damages awarded. That's where courts are looking for the definition of prevailing party, because prevailing party is not defined in this contract, and it's not defined really in any statute. And so we look at the term of art as courts have interpreted. In the Franco case, the United States Supreme Court said, you look at the judgment and whether any party was vindicated by the judgment. Is there a change in legal relationships between the parties? Is there damages awarded to the party? Is someone vindicated by that judgment?
Well, this is a little broader here because it's to enforce the terms of the contract or to declare rights hereunder.
Right.
So why wouldn't the finding that your client breached the contract be a declaration of rights?
Well, Again, there's no definition of what a declaration of rights is, but if you look at the judgment, what rights were declared? Was there a declaration of anybody's rights in the judgment? There was no question that we had a contract. There was no question that that contract required certain things. It required the defendant to develop the lots into a multifamily plat so that KB Homes could come in and develop it. All of the requirements were set on the contract. There was no dispute about what the rights were in the contract.
The jury verdict declares that your client breached the contract, but that their client had no damages. That's why that would be a declaration of rights, wouldn't it?
It could be if someone were to interpret their...
Hard to tell who's... The question is, that's a declaration of rights, but who prevailed?
But you wouldn't appeal from the jury's answer. You would appeal from a judgment. In other words, if it made a difference what the jury said to the outcome of your entitlement or theirs to attorney's fees, then you could take up a judgment if the judgment said you breached the contract or incorporated that in the form of some affirmative relief to the other side. But the jury verdict, you're saying, doesn't make a difference here because it never was... didn't matter to the judgment because there's no evidence of damages.
The jury's verdict did not matter to the judgment, and it didn't declare any relief, didn't declare any change in relationships as a result of the jury's answer to that question. And so we look at, it's what this court said in Southwestern Bell versus Franco. It says it's the judgment, not the verdict, that we must consider in determining whether attorney's fees are proper.
The Court of Appeals seemed to compare it to the Civil Practice of Remedies Code, Chapter 38. And I think it seems like the Court of Appeals presumed that the parties would have been aware of that provision, which says that a person may recover attorney's fees in addition to the amount of a valid claim and costs, and since that provision seems to pin the recovery to some sort of claim recovery, that by excluding that language from the party's agreement, there was no intent that there be a positive recovery.
I think the Court of Appeals did do that, and what it's trying to read into the party's agreement that somehow limiting recovery attorney's fees to the prevailing party, that we somehow wrote out the provision in Chapter 38 that there be a recovery of something in addition to your claim. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that any discussion or anything about any question about what the meaning of prevailing party was, other than a term of art.
But you are looking at case law, interpreting this section to define what a prevailing party is. And if we look to that statute to define prevailing party, isn't it fair to look to that statute to see what was missing from the party's agreement?
The problem with that argument is then it would never give the defendant an opportunity to recover attorney's fees under the prevailing party, because you're still looking at Chapter 38 and the language of Chapter 38 that a prevailing party has to somehow recover on its claim. How can the defendant ever recover on a breach of contract claim, some part of its claim?
Going back to one of the original questions Justice Brister asked, is it your position that the parties agreed that one side or the other would be the prevailing party?
The way this contract was written, one side or the other was going to be the prevailing party.
Okay, no ties.
So the contract's different from Chapter 38. Chapter 38, you have to be bringing a breach of contract action to get attorney's fees.
And only
if you're just defending, you can't get them.
Correct.
But under this contract, somebody's going to get them.
And the prevailing party, and the reason it's in there is prevailing party means a defendant who successfully defends against it changes the American rule. It says, you pay me my attorney's fees. You brought an action to enforce this contract. You didn't prevail. You brought an action to declare your rights, and you got no relief. The defendant is entitled to their attorney's
fees. Did you prove your fees to the trial court?
Did not. We submitted evidence to the jury under our Chapter 38 claim for breach of the oral agreement. But we showed up for a hearing in front of Judge Bobby Flores. We narrowed the issue. It was very clear that nobody was going under Chapter 38. Ms. Bartek, on behalf of KB Home, very clearly said, we are the prevailing party because we got a liability finding, period. We said, no, you're not the prevailing party because you didn't prevail and didn't get the jury on zero, so you had not prevailed on your breach of contract claim. And that's the determining issue. If you determine we're the prevailing party.
To preserve your appellate argument in favor of fees, is there any reason you would have had to present by affidavit or otherwise what your fees were in connection with this?
Well, we did with Judge Flores at the hearing. We said the key issue, obviously, is prevailing party, the threshold issue. If we're not the prevailing party, then there's no need to put on proof. If we are the prevailing party, Judge, we're prepared, one, to incorporate all of the evidence that was presented to the jury on the amount of attorney's fees incurred, and secondly, to testify live and supplement if that's what's needed. But that second step never occurred because he determined KB Home was a prevailing party based on the issue that there was a jury finding of liability.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. McElhaney will present argument for the respondent.
First, I would like to explain to the court that regardless of how the court defines prevailing party, whether it defines prevailing party as it has in the past and has how intermediate courts have defined prevailing party, which is our position in the case, or creates a different definition for prevailing party that is different from existing law, in either respect, KB Home is the prevailing party here.
Can I ask the same question I started with Mr. Castillo, and that is, if Intercontinental had moved for directed verdict and it was granted by the trial court based on his finding or conclusion that there is no evidence of damages, who would have been the prevailing party at that point?
Your Honor, at that point, I don't know that a summary judgment or a directed verdict could have completely disposed of the case because the parties agreed in this contract that the issue of both enforceability and declaring rights under the contract are two separate.
Do you think even if the trial court said no evidence of damages, that's an essential element of a breach of contract case, you would still be entitled to present your evidence that Intercontinental breached and then prevail on that basis?
Yes, that's what the parties decided that they wanted their relationship to.
Based on that one paragraph about prevailing parties?
Yes. Yes, that's what the parties agreed would be controlling in this case. The parties agreed that they wouldn't follow the provisions of Chapter 38, but instead they would only have one requirement to recover fees, and that is to be a prevailing party. Chapter 38 has two requirements: be a prevailing party plus receive some damages. And there's a whole line of case law to explain what those damages are.
What affirmative, other than the fees, what affirmative, how did this change the relationship under our prior case law, or what affirmative relief did you get when you lost, ultimately, the breach of contract case?
Well, I think what Judge Brister said is exactly it. We were right, and they were wrong. This contract, or this lawsuit, started because Intercontinental Group would not abide with the terms of the Santa Clara lot contract.
So you just sued out of moral outrage?
Well, it's more than that, Your Honor, because we did, and it's not moral outrage, but it is extremely important to us, to KB Home, to have our contracts validated. And one of the allegations in this lawsuit, not...
Given what attorney fees run, most clients hope to get something in the end.
I absolutely agree.
And we would just vindication that they were right in their hearts.
I agree, but that's not what the law says prevailing party means, and that's what we're looking at here today. I would like to tell the court that the case law has been that the determination of prevailing party, which is the controlling issue as to whether we are entitled to attorney's fees, is consistently in the case law, meaning, and this court has also said it, it means that we win on the merits, we win on the main issue, we're vindicated by the judgment.
Okay, what I was wondering about, though, was suppose you had the breach finding, but there was an issue of limitations, and you lost on that. Who would be the prevailing party?
In that instance, Your Honor, I think limitations is a threshold issue which would prevent the court or a jury from determining whether, in fact, there was liability.
No, it was not. There were fact questions about when the breach occurred, and it was submitted to the jury. And my experience was defendant's issues come way down on the charge, not at the very beginning.
I agree with you in terms of the timing on the jury charge, but not in regards to the effect of the answers. I think the effect of the answer on liability would be immaterial when the jury finds that that claim was not allowed to be even asserted because it was barred by limitations.
And what if the there had been a finding of no consideration?
If there had been a finding of no consideration, then that, in fact, would be kind of like a declaration regarding the rights of the parties. It would, if they had found that there was no consideration, if that was an issue in this case, which it wasn't, then we would have lost on the declaration of our rights, and so we would not have been a prevailing party.
So can you think of an element of the claim or a defense that if the defendant won on it would not make them the prevailing party other than the lack of proof of damages?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I have thought about the question in that respect. Can give the court a quick answer to that question. What I can tell you is that in the posture of this case and under the terms of this particular contract, attorney's fees provision, the ability to recover fees was for prevailing on enforcing the contract, which would then be fees or some kind of damages, I would agree with. But there was also this second element where we could prevail, and that was if we prevailed on declaring our rights or determining our rights under the contract. And that was an embedded component of this lawsuit. It was a very hotly contested issue in this case as to whether the Santa Clara lot contract was in fact a valid contract and whether it was indeed even enforceable.
How long was the trial?
The trial was 6 days. Ms. Hall here, one of my colleagues, was one of the trial lawyers.
How much of the trial focused on breach of contract and how much on damages?
That is such a good question, Your Honor, because I want to point this out, and I think it's important, and I might have been forgotten to point it out. This is a partial record case. We do not have the transcript of the entire trial before you. Rather, the petitioners brought this case to you on a partial record and didn't list, as the rules require, what their issues presented were going to be, as the requirements are under the rules. Most important, then, is that this court must presume that the rest of the record that's not here supports the trial court's judgment. So what was the trial court's assertion here? What did the trial court decide? The trial court decided that the main issue, the merits of this case, was liability, was who was right and who was wrong, who breached the contract. And underneath that allegation, underneath that finding in the jury charge, was also a resolution by the jury of a hotly contested issue about whether the Santa Clara lot contract was indeed a valid contract, that it was not a product of fraud, but in fact was a valid contract, because that was one of the affirmative, not just an affirmative defense, but an affirmative claim that IG, I'll call them IG for the sake of confusion, that IG asserted in this case and sought damages for. In their pleadings, they expressly sought damages against KB Home on the theory that the Santa Clara lot contract was invalid as a product of fraud, or that we had breached the contract, we had breached some obligation under the Santa Clara lot contract that allowed them to cancel the contract. And that allegation made them assert a claim for actual damages because they said, because we improperly prevented them from selling lots, we put these pendants in place and we took other steps to try and prevent those lots from being sold. IG affirmatively sought damages against us.
When you started your presentation, you said under any definition, mm-hmm. the prevailing party, you meet it. I'm kind of just thinking back to federal and state employment law, which often makes a prevailing party eligible for recovery of attorney's fees. But as I understand the case law in that context, as Justice Hecht alluded to, moral satisfaction isn't enough. A judicial finding that somebody broke the law isn't enough. If it's unaccompanied by injury, by damages, a technical victory unaccompanied by equitable relief or an award of money damages cannot bestow prevailing party status in the employment law context.
Well, and I would tell you that that is a context that's not applicable here, because the concept of prevailing party is one you created, and you created it in the beginning with the Green International versus Solis case, and it has developed ever since.
What I keep coming back to that confuses me is those cases relate to the statute, and we're not looking at the statute. I can read this attorney's fee provision of your contract to mean in a suit for specific performance or a suit for declaratory judgment, and this suit did not involve either of those things.
Could I disagree with you, Your Honor? Because I do believe that this case did, in fact, include declarations of the rights under the contract.
But only to the extent a breach of contract action does.
Exactly. But that is every – at least this breach of contract claim did subsume those declarations, and so – and we won on those declarations.
No, I understand that. But we use a suit for specific performance, and a declaratory judgment, by definition, don't carry damages with them, else you sue for breach of contract. And so you dropped your specific performance claim, and the other one says to declare rights, and they don't talk about damages. So it almost sounds like if you're going to sue for specific performance or declaratory judgment, then the losing party has to pay. But doesn't say anything about a breach of contract action for damages. Could it be read that way?
I think it could be read that way, Your Honor, but I think what I think is probably another explanation or construction of the contract term is that probably falls more in place with what parties would generally expect, is that enforcement means obtaining some kind of damages or some kind of specific performance, whereas declaring rights refers to if there's a controversy about whether the contract is valid or not, what rights parties have under the contract, the party that wins those aspects of the case is a prevailing party. And it's either one of those. If you win either one of those, you're a prevailing party.
Is it your position, the same as other counsel's, that the parties in this case agreed that in the event of a lawsuit over the contract, one party or the other would be the prevailing
party? I disagree. I think there can be a push. I think there can be a situation where we might not have either prevailed on enforcement or on having our rights determined the way we think that the contract should have been determined. And at the same time, especially in a case like this, where the petitioners here actually asserted affirmative claims against KB based on the contract, and they lost both of those. They lost enforcement and they lost declaration of rights because the jury wholesale disregarded and sided against them on all of their claims regarding the enforceability of the contract. And remember, they also tried to say that they had properly canceled the contract, and the jury said no to that as well. And that would have been an attempt to enforce paragraph 15 of the contract. So in this situation, it could be seen a scenario where both parties lost on all of their efforts to recover, and then in that situation, Your Honor, I would say there'd be a push, and there'd be no prevailing
party. You could look at it the other way around. Both parties prevailed against the claim against them.
And in that situation, Your Honor, I would say it then is kicked to the trial judge, who has been watching the trial for the last 6 days, who sees how many witnesses had to do with liability and how many witnesses had to do with damages, who presided over the case for several years in the process of discovery, who was there when the jury came in and gave its verdict, and one set of lawyers looked like this and one set of lawyers gave high fives. It is that reason why the standard of review for determining who is the prevailing party is based on abuse of discretion.
But the trial judge decides that.
Because the trial judge decided that, and why
wouldn't the jury decide who's the prevailing party?
Well, in this case, no
y'all
one
both argued it to the judge. So
that's right. I could see an instance, Your Honor, where
it's norm. almost always we give attorney's fees questions to the jury in every other circumstance.
We do, but we don't. It's actually the judge who decides whether those fees are actually going to be awarded or not. And that does bring me to an important point. The hearing where the two parties were arguing about who is entitled to attorney's fees, that hearing asserted two issues. Who is entitled and how much are your fees? We both argued we were prevailing parties. At the close of the hearing, Mr. Calvillo, who was trial counsel, and this is in the record because we supplemented the record with this, Mr. Calvillo said he had affidavits and that he would file them, and the judge said, do what you want. I think I have enough. And Mr. Calvillo never filed those affidavits. So there was no evidence before the court.
Would there be anything that prevented? So it sounds to me, two questions. First, it sounds to me like you're saying who the prevailing party is a question of mixed fact and law for the trial judge to be judged, reviewed on appeal by abuse of discretion. Sounds like what you're saying.
I think I would agree with that. I don't. I guess it is a question of fact because I am saying there's lawyers that are high-fiving and there are lawyers that are downtrodden.
That sounds like it to me.
But wouldn't it be awful to require us to have a record at the end of a trial, which we would have done in this case, that
let
said...
Let the record reflect.
Let the record reflect that Ms. McElhaney, right, as the appellate lawyer, is high-fiving.
Right.
And
right.
Ms. I guess I still don't understand, though. If the trial, let's just say there's summary judgment or directed verdict, trial court grants it in favor of Intercontinental and says, on the same day, here's my judgment, it's take nothing because there's no damages. And you're saying at that point, judge, that's not the end of the matter. The trial needs to continue on my breach of contract action. Then the judge says, that's done. I mean, you can't, there's no way you can recover. You can appeal this, you know, this judgment if you want to, but this finally resolves all the facts and legal matters before me.
The first thing that I would do, Your Honor, is I would ask the trial judge to give us a ruling on liability. And so that, and I would hope.
And I would say take nothing. That's your liability ruling.
Okay, so my liability ruling is no liability. Then I've lost on enforcement and I've lost on my declaration of rights. And so I have lost. And so I am not entitled to attorney's fees. But in this case, we have a different scenario here. Because, in fact, we did get the declarations that we wanted. Whether you call them a declaration, you know, the law doesn't allow us to assert a separate declaratory judgment action when the issues of declaration are subsumed within the breach of contract. So it would have been, if we are set a standard like this, then we are now going to be requiring parties to specifically plead out the legal determinations, not legal, the determinations that they need to have regarding their contract. And enforceability and validity was a huge issue in this case.
My other question was, would anything prevent parties from drafting a provision that said whoever wins on the breach of contract action gets their attorney's fees regardless of what the damage question says?
Your Honor, the parties get to they certainly could do that. The
contract only, anything they want.
They can until the legislature decides that that's not proper and on a policy basis enters or creates a statute that says, no, you can't do that.
So really the question for us here is whether in this provision the parties intended, what the parties intend to happen when you won breach of contract and but zero damages.
Right. And you know, I think it's really important for us to, and Judge O'Neill, you brought up a good point. Why do we keep going back to Chapter 38? And we go back to Chapter 38 because the concept of prevailing party was created in the context of this court and other intermediate courts, deciding what the meaning of Chapter 38 is. Because the language of 38 is such that it recognizes that you could have a valid claim but still have a separate requirement, that is, you need to be recover actual damages.
Okay, so if it's true then that the parties can contract for whatever they want, and that's what you say that they've done here, and it's what your opposing counsel says also, and so we can throw out all the jurisprudence about what prevailing party means because the parties say what it is.
No, I disagree. And here's why. Because this contract term uses the word prevailing party. So we have to assume that the parties, and they didn't define what prevailing party means. So we have to go to the law to see what prevailing party means under this contract.
Normally in a contract situation, we go to the common and ordinary meaning of the term, not to the legal definition of a term,
unless
specified otherwise.
I would agree, and I think we went under that too, because if you look at the Black's Law Dictionary definition that was used in Flagship and many of the other cases that are so specific about what prevailing party means, they used a Black's Law Dictionary meaning that is win on the merits, win on the main issue, the party that was vindicated. And I assure you, the party that was vindicated here was KB Home. And we must presume that also because we have a limited record. But if we didn't have a limited record, but I can't say that because I'm going to limit myself to the record.
I guess my question would be is, how do we advance the ball here jurisprudentially?
I think that's a great question.
This provision in the contract. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to the jurisprudence of the state that we decide what this provision means when everybody can change it from?
Well, and you've got a good point there, because this provision, it was argued to you that this provision is in every real estate contract, and it's a part of the standard real estate contract, but that's not right. The word prevailing party is, but the rest of our language is actually fairly unique. The issue about enforcement and declaring rights is unique to ours. But I do think it would be helpful. I really do. I mean, I wish you hadn't granted the petition, to tell you the truth. I love arguing with you guys, but you know, my client would have loved to just have the petition denied. But I do think it will be helpful to the intermediate courts, to the district courts, and frankly to people in my office that are writing contracts, to have a clear understanding that prevailing party means wins on the merits, regardless of the amount of damages or whether damages is even awarded. That's the case law that's out there. I do agree in some instances that's been muddied. I think this is an opportunity for this court to clarify that and follow the precedent that it set, and that it followed most recently in the Mustang case, where this court said that the Mustang pipeline won on liability, and so they therefore had a valid claim, which is prevailing party. But even despite having a valid claim and being with the prevailing party, they could not recover under Chapter 38 because they did not recover any damages.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Definition of prevailing party in this contract and this court's opinion is going to be important, because the term prevailing party does appear in statute and appears in numerous contracts. It appears in the property code, enforcement of condominium association rules.
We could limit the opinion to just defining prevailing party under the contract. We could limit the opinion to that.
And so if prevailing party, the definition of prevailing party and what that means to people who enter into a real estate contract or any contract or this contract is important, because what the Court of Appeal said is we answer that question by determining the answer to the question on liability, simply just liability. And so that's the case. Then, as a plaintiff, all I have to do is show liability, and I'm the prevailing party under one of these breach of contract claims. I never have to get to my damages.
But I'm wondering about your opposing party's proposition. Is that it's a mixed question of law and fact. I mean, I can think of, I know the U.S. Supreme Court has said, you know, if you recover a dollar, you're a prevailing party, period. And that's a nice, easy, bright-line rule, and there's advantages to that. On the other hand, I can think of a lot of cases. I can think of cases where getting $1 is a big loss to the plaintiff. I can think of other cases where saying, defendant, you did something wrong, plaintiff gets a dollar, is a big win for the plaintiff. It really depends on what the fight was about, whether getting a dollar was a win or a loss. Why shouldn't we take into account all of the facts about what the fight was really about and who really prevailed in deciding whether when you got a dollar, you won or you lost?
You should take a look at what this fight was about. And where do you start? You start at plaintiff's original petition, and you look at the jury charge, and you look at the final judgment. Whatever she indicated that the case might have been or was something else, it was nothing other than breach of contract or specific performance. It was specific performance and alternatively breach of contract. And the prayer for relief was judgment for damages.
How much was asked? How much?
They presented to the jury $1.2 million. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you look at the final judgment. And the final judgment didn't declare any rights. It didn't enforce any rights. It didn't vindicate the plaintiff. KB Holmes might think that they've been vindicated, but at the end of the day, it's not a matter of who high fives. A defendant was sued for $1.2 million for breach of contract.
Did you waive any or all of your arguments here today by bringing a partial record instead of the full record?
No, Your Honor. I think that the answer to that question is, I know they cite the Feldman versus Marx case, a 1996 case by this court, but I think the answer to that question is in First Supermarkets versus Bethune case, where a party may request a partial reporter's record, and I think that case answers that question. But let's assume that she's correct, that somehow I should have had the transcript of the 6 days of trial and every exhibit. We have the exhibits, but not every word that was spoken 6 days of trial. Let's assume that's correct. You still look at the judgment. Was anybody vindicated by that judgment? What was this case about? Where is the vindication? You look at the judgment. Was there any declaration of rights? No. Was there any damages? No. Was there any change in...
What in the contract says you look at the judgment?
It doesn't. It says prevailing party.
But, I mean, people do bring, declaratory judgment actions where you don't get any damages at all. And we do leave it up to the trial judge to say some discretion who was really the winner here in Chapter 37. Why shouldn't we do that here?
Because in Chapter 37... it's a declaration of somebody's rights, remedies, or obligations under a written agreement.
Well, let me get back to Justice Brister's original question I think we started the arguments with. If we were to decide in your favor, then you would be a prevailing party under the plain language of the party's agreement.
Yes.
And so you'd have the rather perverse result that you didn't prevail on any substantive issue in the case, and yet you get your attorney's fees. And isn't that sort of an odd result?
Absolutely not. Because the result is a defendant can prevail on a cause of action by defeating liability or damages. A plaintiff has to show both. What the court's going to be doing is flipping that situation where a plaintiff, all he has to do is show liability. I'm home free. I recover my attorney's fees because I've shown liability. I don't have to show damages. A defendant, on the other hand, has to defeat both liability and damages. And you're actually flipping the established burden of proof and whose burden is it to show on a breach of contract.
KB were awarded $1. Would you have a different position here?
I would have a different position because they were awarded a nominal amount. And if you look at the United States Supreme Court, They've looked in the Farrar case. If you look at nominal damages, can they be awarded attorney's fees? Then the amount is in question. But certainly they've said a judicial pronouncement that someone has violated even a constitutional requirement does not bestow prevailing party status on the plaintiff.
Would you address briefly counsel's position that you did not perfect your appeal in regard to attorney's fees?
Yes. That transcript where
preserve error. Did the trial court tell you that you didn't have to introduce evidence in order to preserve error on your post-trial attorney's fees hearing?
No, the trial court didn't. At the hearing, both parties asked the court to take judicial notice of the amount of attorney's fees testified to at trial. KB Home did the very same thing, and obviously had a jury finding that said 66 or one-third, and the defendant had also testified about attorney's fees under its oral agreement, concept under Chapter 38, and we asked the court to take notice of all the testimony that had been provided at that trial concerning the breach of contract claim.
No question, the trial court understood that if you prevailed, you wanted your attorney's fees.
No question, Your Honor. No question. And if the court would look at the reporter's record, Volume 4, it's the transcript of that hearing in July. It's very clear that was the question. That was the only issue. That was the only – in fact, we moved for an entry of a judgment. That was the only issue that was being preserved. Who was the prevailing party? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.